If it pleases the Court, I will make three points this morning. First, that the provision in Section 512.080F of the Chicago Residential Landlord and Tenants Ordinance is, in fact, a penalty. Number two, that, in fact, this penalty is uninsurable as a matter of Illinois law. And three, that the claimed ambiguity in Section 5, Paragraph 3B of the policy is both not ambiguous, number one, and number two, even if it is ambiguous, under either interpretation of that policy.
Why are you starting with the exclusion from the policy rather than with the coverage clause?
Yes, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that there is coverage, and what I'm saying is, number two, that where Judge Grady found...
Doesn't one start with the coverage clause?
Yes, Your Honor. And what I will argue, and if you want me to turn to that first, I can, but what I'm saying basically is that there is coverage. If you look at the, if we look at the policy specifically, it says the company will pay on behalf of the insured all sums in excess of the deductible amount stated in the declarations, which the insured shall become legally obligated to pay as damages. Okay? And so what I'm doing then is going from damages up to Section 5, Paragraph 3. And damages are compensatory monetary amounts for which the insured may be held legally liable, including awards or settlements negotiated with the approval of the company. Now, it's interesting that in that first portion of A, you don't see the word penalties there. You see awards or settlements. When you go down to B, and incidentally, the reason that Judge Grady made the error he did...
Lost me.
Excuse me?
You're losing me. I had thought you were arguing in your brief that there was no coverage because these awards did not come within the term damages. They weren't compensatory. You've just conceded on your feet that the coverage clause does cover this.
No, Your Honor, that's not correct. What I'm saying is this.
You've lost me. I now don't understand what you're arguing.
I'm obviously not being clear. Let me go back for a moment. What I'm saying is that, first of all, the first portion where it says that damages are a compensatory amount or award, from there is taken out awards that are deemed uninsurable pursuant to applicable law. What Judge Grady looked at and what Judge Grady found ambiguous was simply looking at Section B, and he said the question turns on whether the term awards deemed uninsurable pursuant to applicable law applies to penalties?
Look, maybe I should just give up. I do not understand how we even get to the exclusions unless something is covered. And I had understood you to be arguing in your brief that because these awards were not compensatory damages, they were not within the scope of the coverage clause.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Therefore, essentially everything that the district court wrote is irrelevant.
But
you also tell me that you're going to devote your entire oral argument to the irrelevance.
No, Your Honor, I am saying I agree with your first statement, the antecedent to what you were saying, namely that it's not covered. It's not covered because, one, it's in fact a penalty, and it's not covered, two, because in fact, as a matter of Illinois law, it's not covered. Now, under B, which gets to what damages do not include. I mean, I agree with what the court said, that this is a penalty, and as a result of it being a penalty, it's not...
I agree with what the court said. I'm trying to figure out what your argument is.
Your Honor, I think my argument's pretty clear here.
Your argument has me totally and utterly confused. It's not clear to me that you understand what's in your own brief.
Well, Your Honor, okay. If I may... I think that if we start from the beginning, that this is, in fact, a penalty.
That's not the beginning, but I give up.
Oh, well.
I'll ask a question and take you in a little different area. Can an Illinois court award damages in an amount less than two times the security deposit under the RLTO?
Not under the penalty. They can for damages if there are damage in addition to the penalty, but not – it's automatic.
It's automatic.
Yes, Your Honor.
So is it possible that the RLTO is written in such a formulaic manner not because it meant to impose an automatic penalty, but because the drafters of the statute sought to decrease the burden on overtaxed housing courts, you know, where there is a lot of litigation that involve very small sums of money, and it was deemed, you know, well, it would be efficient to set a formula rather than squabble over minor amounts of loss.
I think the answer to your question is no, Your Honor. And the reason for that is set forth in Nehmer versus Habitat and also in McDonald's versus Levine. There the court says, look, we look to determine whether it's a penalty based upon several things. One, if the amount awarded is automatic. Number two, if the amount is set by statute or by ordinance. And number three, if it's awarded irrespective of damages, then it is a penalty, as opposed to, in fact, it being liability being imposed only for actual damages for the violation. And so if we look at the clearest criteria for determining whether it's a penalty or not, the Nehmer case actually deals with that issue and says that, no, it's a penalty. Now, after Nehmer, we turn then to this Court's Mortensen decision. And I might suggest that in Mortensen, and also in Plembeck, Your Honor, that we cite Plembeck versus Greystone, the appellate court there called this at 666 Northeast 2nd, 677. They actually referred to this as a penalty. That's what they called it. Now, if we turn to this Court's Mortensen decision, which is the closest case on point in terms of dealing with the issue of insurance coverage for this particular type of conduct, there the plaintiff, the insured argued, as the insured argues here, that one, these penalties were not defined in the policy. Two, they argued, as Eastlake argues here, that there was an ambiguity in the policy. Three, they argued that, in fact, it required deliberate wrongdoing in order for there to be not to be insurable. And despite those arguments, the court rejected each one of those arguments, and the court held, in fact, that the penalty in that particular case was not, in fact, insurable. And Judge Posner, in writing the opinion of the court, said that any other interpretation.
You were here during the last argument, were you not?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You were here during the last argument, were you not?
Yeah, I was in and out.
What significance do you think it has that one judge rather than another of this court wrote a particular opinion?
Nothing. I'm simply mentioning that he was the author of the opinion.
Then it's irrelevant.
Okay. In any event.
So I asked whether you were here when I reminded your immediate predecessor that we keep personalities out of it.
Your Honor, I was in the mention with some part, so I did not hear that. I'm sorry. In any event, the interpretation of the insurance policy is done this way so that they do not inject the type of uncertainty into the interpretation of these policies that would otherwise be the case.
Is it possible that the RLTO is a new breed of animal, part damages, part penalty?
I think it is, but I think that the provision of the statute, Your Honor, that we're looking at right now is the penalty provision. We're not talking about the damages provision. If there are actual damages, this ordinance awards those damages. But the penalty provision, which is what we're talking about here, which is the $308,000 plus the $100,000, which was the attorney's fees that related to counts one and count two of the complaint in the underlying lawsuit, those are, in fact, penalties. Those are not damages. They are awarded regardless of whether the individual plaintiff has that or tenant has damages or has no damages. They are an automatic award and thus makes them a penalty. And they are not insurable under Illinois law, pursuant to Mortensen. And the argument that is being given by Eastlake is, well, it's not the type of argument, it's not the type of willfulness or intentional conduct that's involved. But, Your Honor, that argument was rejected in Mortensen. And, in fact, in Mortensen, what the court said is basically a penalty is a penalty is a penalty. And we don't look to that sort of issue. We simply look to see what it is. And in this particular case, the type of penalty involved is the one that the court is concerned about in terms of moral hazard. You recall in Mortensen, the court there said that we have to look to the question of the moral hazard that would be involved. In this particular case, there would be no incentive for a landlord to comply with this particular ordinance if they could insure it. And the reason for that is fairly simple. What happens is they don't pay interest on their security deposit, and they keep the interest. If, in fact, there's a penalty, they would then say, well, the penalty is paid by the insurance company. There's no incentive to obey the law unless the Mortensen argument is followed, namely that this type of penalty is not insurable. Now, as far as the ambiguity goes, and I want to turn to that. Judge Rovner, have I answered the question?
Yes,
that you asked?
Of course.
Okay. Judge Easterbrook, my point, and I don't know if I made the point clear or not, I say that the penalties in this case are not covered under the policy. They're not insured. And the district judge arrived at his opinion, finding an ambiguity in Section B as to that section, because of two things. First of all, he said that the phrase awards deemed uninsurable pursuant to any applicable law can be interpreted to refer to penalties or to simply awards. And my point in the beginning was it makes no difference if the insurer in this case does not insure penalties, and if the phrase is only meant to apply to awards deemed uninsurable pursuant to applicable law, penalties are not covered. And if it is, in fact, interpreted to apply to just the last phrase, it's still not covered because they are uninsurable pursuant to applicable law. And I hope that point at least is clarified if I was not clear about that before. My time is up. So.
No, it's not up, and I rather hope that you will address what seems to me potentially the Eastlake's strongest argument, which is that your client defended this case for 2 years in state court without a reservation of rights. Why is this Johnny-come-lately position now open to you?
Well, Your Honor, I think that there are several arguments to that. First of all, on February 25th, 2003, the parties entered into an agreement in which they acknowledged that they were proceeding pursuant to a reservation of rights, number one, and number two, that they waived their right to select independent counsel. Number two, in this court's Allstate versus Tozer case, the court held that waiver and estoppel cannot be used to expand coverage. In that case, 2004 case, and that's exactly what would be happening here. If, in fact, Illinois law does not permit that to be insured, those penalties to be insured, that can't be waived. Admittedly, the Allstate case was under Indiana law, but we have found no Illinois case that is contrary to that or discusses that subject. And other cases that we do cite...
Is that perhaps why you're concentrating on the exclusion clause rather than the coverage clause?
I hadn't thought that that was the reason, Your Honor. No. I thought the waiver argument itself, Your Honor, had no merit.
You lost me again. My understanding of Illinois law is that an insurer who defends the insured without a reservation of rights can't change its mind later and assert that the contract doesn't cover it if that delay caused any prejudice.
Well,
and, of course, Eastlake says it did cause prejudice because they could have settled the suit for less earlier. Now, that may or may not be true, but it's what Eastlake is arguing. Now, if I understood what you just said correctly, you're saying that that principle does not apply if the casualty is uninsurable as a matter of state law as opposed to just not insured under this contract. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that, and I'm also saying that this is not a situation in which we refuse to defend. To the contrary, we recognize our obligation to defend. We did defend, and we're not seeking to get back, in this case, Your Honor, those fees that we, in fact, incurred in defending. The concept of estoppel does not apply.
I don't see how, unless there is this principle that something that's uninsurable is outside the scope of this state policy, I don't see how we could rule in your favor without sending it back for an evidentiary hearing to deal with Eastlake's theory that delay in reserving rights caused prejudice in the management of the litigation, caused them to pay more than they would otherwise have had to pay.
Well, Your Honor, the cases do say that, in fact, waiver is a factual matter, and that the insured has the burden of proof on that claim by clear and convincing evidence. You recall this case comes up on cross motions for summary judgment, so I would agree that that's correct. It could not be resolved on summary judgment.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you, Mr. Ryder. Mr. Conklin.
May it please the Court, Counsel. The District Court correctly found Section 3B ambiguous because the qualifying phrase is admitted by Nutmeg's claim manager could reasonably be read to modify the undefined term penalty.
You think it modifies the word taxes in that phrase?
I think it's ambiguous, and my answer would be yes. I think that the qualifying phrase...
an uninsurable tax.
I cannot answer that question. I've never thought of an uninsurable tax.
Incoherent.
It is.
Doesn't that suggest that the phrase deemed uninsurable under applicable law should be governed by the rule of the immediate antecedent?
I believe it does not, because under Illinois law...
It's incoherent to apply it to other words in the same phrase. One would ordinarily read a document to be coherent rather than nonsense. And if your reading makes it nonsense, it's hardly a sensible reading.
Well, I think it would be plausible to read it penalties or awards deemed uninsurable and apply it to the last two in the sentence.
That's
entirely
plausible.
I don't
think you could find any grammarian who would take that view. The phrase deemed uninsurable under applicable law either modifies everything that goes before it or only the immediate antecedent. I don't think there's any other option.
I would agree with you that there's two options, but it's not incumbent upon the insured to write a clear policy.
The problem is you're making an argument under which Nutmeg Insurance Company has written a policy that says if Eastlake fails to pay its income tax, Nutmeg has to pay the income tax in its stead. That's what you say this policy requires, and it's inconceivable.
I would disagree, because if you modify the word taxes with deemed uninsurable pursuant to applicable law and take the Mortenson case as the example, it would be uninsurable under Illinois law or any law that I'm aware of to shift the burden of paying income taxes for a willful violation of an IRS regulation over to an insurance company.
I'm not saying anything about willfulness.
Well, Mortenson's a good example, because there was specifically a penalty. But even putting aside the qualifier, this is not a penal statute here for a number of reasons.
I couldn't get Mr. Ryder to talk about the coverage clause, but maybe I can get you to talk about the coverage clause.
Sure, Judge.
Let's suppose Eastlake buys an automobile. And it buys it on credit, and it doesn't pay. The seller goes to court and gets a judgment for the price of the automobile. Can you require Nutmeg to pay that judgment on the ground that since the exclusion clause is ambiguous and the price of an automobile is not uninsurable under state law, therefore Nutmeg has to pay for your automobile?
No, I think that's...
No, and the reason is because the coverage clause refers to compensatory damages and not the price for something Eastlake has purchased in the market.
Correct.
Well, interest is just the price for something you purchase in the market. Interest is the price for the time value of money. And if you agree that this policy doesn't cover the price of an automobile, I don't see how it covers the price of money.
I'm not following your question, but going back to the insuring clause, the first part of it, it says all amounts that Eastlake becomes legally obligated to pay as damages for a wrongful act. Here we have a settlement agreement negotiated by Nutmeg.
if I borrow money from you and don't pay the interest,
okay,
it's just the same as buying a car from you and not paying the price. I have failed to carry out an obligation to pay for that which I got. Now, if you concede that the policy does not require Nutmeg to pay the price of the automobile, why does it require Nutmeg to pay the price of money?
I see. I misunderstood your question.
It's a question about the scope of the coverage clause.
Sure. And here, I think it's important to point out that there is no allegation that any tenant didn't get their money back, and that is both their security deposits and interest. That's actually acknowledged in the underlying complaint. The complaint says after the buildings were sold, the security deposits and interest were transferred to Urban. So it isn't actually a factual scenario, as Your Honor set it up, because they were, in fact, paid. And that's not what is happening here.
Your brief says that the funds were transferred to a third party. That's different from saying that the tenants were paid. Right? If you go back to my automobile example.
Yes.
You buy a car from Joe Smith Auto Dealer. You owe Joe Smith $30,000. Instead of giving the $30,000 to Joe Smith, you give it to the American Red Cross, and Smith sues you. You can't defend that suit by saying, well, I took the $30,000 and gave it to somebody else,
right,
so I don't owe you.
But here, Nutmeg's entire argument is premised on a single false predicate, and that's that Eastlake took something to which it was not entitled. Illinois law specifically allows a landlord or a management company to transfer interest as a credit at closing. Eastlake never received any benefit of anything. It never took anything.
Well, what do you make of Nutmeg's argument that an insured landlord who fails to adhere to the requirements of the RLTO gets to keep the windfall of the security deposit it unlawfully held plus the interest it failed to pay without it spending money on attorney's fees, while the insurance company is left to pay all of the damages or penalties, whichever you want to call it, and the cost of defending the suit?
I would say two things. First of all, in the policy itself, there's a specific exclusion that would deal with that, and that's for fraud, willful intention to violate the law, essentially taking someone's money. The policy's dealt with that. But secondly, that would certainly be uninsurable pursuant to Illinois law. We are not arguing that an insurance company should provide coverage to somebody who steals money. And more importantly, none of that happened here. There is just no evidence that Eastlake did anything wrong. What we have here is a settlement agreement negotiated with approval of Nutmeg, in fact, negotiated by Nutmeg. They funded it, and now they want to get their money back, which is expressly barred by the Illinois Supreme Court's rule on general agents.
You know, this might be irrelevant, but, you know, it's the kind of thing that keeps me up at night. I don't understand why, then, you would have agreed to settlement. I mean, I would have been inclined to think that proving Eastlake's innocence, so to speak, in the underlying matter, which, you know, it was not relevant to the case before us, but since you spend a good portion of your brief defending that position, I mean, why settle if you assert the allegations by the Hale plaintiffs were utterly baseless?
Well, first of all, Nutmeg, through its claim manager, has admitted that she found no evidence of wrongdoing. But more importantly, I think it's important for the court to understand how the settlement took place. There was a settlement demand made on a Friday, which was kept open until the following Monday. On that Monday, Nutmeg's coverage counsel, Nutmeg's appointed defense counsel, and the plaintiff's attorneys met, and they arrived at a settlement. After that, Eastlake called up to say, you know, what are the terms, and how am I going to be protected from Nutmeg? How is it allocated? And he was told by his appointed defense counsel, as you know, and this is a quote, I have no power to impact the terms of settlement. The Hartford has agreed with the claimant's attorney to a settlement, and any variance from those terms can only be affected by those two parties. I can certainly deliver your request to them as a messenger. After that, Nutlake thought Eastlake thought the amount was too high because of its innocence and said so. Then Nutmeg turned around and said, if you don't agree to this, we're going to invoke the cooperation clause and withdraw from the defense entirely, coupled with a claim release that they wanted Eastlake to sign.
Is this all in the record?
It is.
Okay.
A claim release that they wanted Eastlake to sign, where Eastlake would waive all of its rights, including the bad faith claim it had below, and other defenses here, which Eastlake respectfully refused to sign, and then they finally signed off on the settlement agreement. In addition, the agreement itself says it cannot be used as evidence of guilt, and that agreement, and this is also in the record, was reviewed by Nutmeg's coverage counsel before it even went to defense counsel. So I think it's important for the court to understand how the settlement took place here. Briefly, I'd like to mention three other reasons why. And I'd like to correct the record on one thing. The February 2003 letter was simply a bare notice of reservation of rights. The only evidence in the record, and this is Exhibit 7, is that Eastlake received its first reservation of rights letter 46 months after suit began, for a specific one, and that's the one dated January. Under general agents, an insurer is barred from seeking any monies it pays unless two things are true. First, there is a specific policy right to do so here in Section J. All Nutmeg did is reserve the right to reimbursement if it paid money before or below or above the policy limit. And secondly, they reserved that right. If you look at the reservation of rights letters they tried to send and tried to the reservation they tried to make, on page 4 they say, we're reserving the right in the event of judgment.
Excuse me, is this a letter they tried to send or did they actually send it?
They sent it, but it wasn't received until 2004. The only evidence in the record is in September of 2004.
You're saying that the letter took 2 years to deliver?
No, what happened was Eastlake said, can you give me all the letters that have been going on in this case? They were starting to discuss settlement. Ms. Morell, the claim manager handling this file, sent a 50-page fax to Eastlake. And prior to that time, we had a bare notice of reservation of rights and Mr. Bannister having a general discussion. But under our board marine and 20 years of Illinois insurance law, bare notice is insufficient to preserve anything. I also want to mention that in the Tozer case, there's an exception. If an insurer knows of facts that it could raise to try and deny coverage, it must reserve those rights. And I would point this court towards the Gibraltar case, where the underlying facts are the same except for one thing. That involved a murder. The defendant was convicted, and then there was a civil wrongful death case. There, the insurance company stepped in, appointed an attorney. That attorney defended. And 16 months later, they said, we want to reserve our rights to apply the intentional acts exclusion.
Let me take up the question of prejudice from the delay. Your brief says there was prejudice because you could have settled for less early on. How does one know that? Was there an offer on the table to settle for less?
This is based on Mr. Bannister's testimony, but there are three other elements to prejudice.
You can answer my question yes or no. Was there an offer on the table to settle for less?
I don't believe a formal offer was made, no. I think it was general discussions.
There was nothing one could have accepted. Then what makes you think that you could have settled for less?
Based on the general discussions Mr. Bannister was aware of, as he testified to in his deposition. That is the evidence in the record.
Since I have not read his deposition, perhaps you would oblige me by answering my question.
He said, I thought it could be settled for $50,000 to $90,000 at the beginning of the case.
And what did he have a reason?
Yes. General discussions with the plaintiff's attorneys and other counsel defending the case. That was at the very beginning of the case. But there's also prejudice because Number one, they defended the case for more than 2 years by their own admission, without a reservation, and they had the opportunity to steer it towards a non-covered position, which is what the attorney did. He filed a motion to dismiss the only count on which coverage is not contested today, the habitability count. In addition, there was a notation in the underwriting file that we discovered below, which said, we're not going to review the 1,700 class member tenant files because the task is too arduous. I would submit that they meant expensive. That email further says, we're only going to do it if class was certified and it was never done. That is the only way you could properly defend this case, is to look at each tenant file, get the evidence they got their security deposit, got their interest, and so there's more evidence of just trying to settle the case earlier in terms of prejudice.
Do you concede that there needs to be a showing of prejudice?
For estoppel, yes, but I think...
For waiver. If the insurance... Are there not cases in Illinois that hold that if the reservation of rights is late, it's late. It constitutes a waiver of that reservation of rights.
Absolutely. Keller in Gibraltar, I see I'm out of time. If you'd like me to expand on my answer, I'd be happy to discuss that.
I'd like to.
Sure.
You have to say, yes.
I think the Gibraltar case, even though it talks in terms of both estoppel and waiver, but there they said you waited 16 months. Waiver is defined under Illinois law as the intentional relinquishment of a known right. From day one, they knew what these allegations were. From day one, they said nothing for more than 2 years by their own admission, for 4 years, according to Eastlake. And it, obviously, none of the facts changed. This isn't based on new evidence. The Keller case said 9 months was too long to wait. Gibraltar uses waiver language and says 16 months is too long to wait. Here, according to Eastlake, we have 46.
So under Illinois law, waiver and estoppel are two really separate concepts, aren't they?
Yeah. On waiver, you only focus on the insurer. You don't focus on what the insurer did, nor does there have to be any showing of prejudice. On estoppel, there has to be prejudice, but the Illinois cases we cite, in some cases, say the length of time is sufficient. I certainly think 46 months is sufficient here.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Conklin. Mr. Ryder, I'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honor, a few points here. First of all, on May 27, 2000, first of all, there were no demands, no settlement offers prior to any time that were less than the amount that was settled for. They settled within the policy limits. On May 27, 2005, there was an email from Mr. Bannister to Mr. Haber of the Iwan Cray firm, says that Hartford should rethink its settlement position and that was presented today. They're asking them to actually settle the case. Then on May 27th, again, they make a demand. They say demand is made on that to settle the Hale litigation. Then on August 4th, after the settlement is discussed and entered into, and it's not yet finalized, Mr. Conklin's firm writes back and says, Eastlake has not said that it is revoking the settlement. That is A179 in the appendix. As far as the general agency case goes, that was a case in which the parties delayed in sending out the reservation of rights letter, and then the issue was whether they could recover later for defense costs where there were some question about whether they weren't defending the case at that point in time. That is not at all involved here. I want to come back for one more moment to something that you asked earlier, Judge Easterbrook, and that is about the coverage. And I didn't understand the question, and so I didn't answer it as clearly as I should have. And what's involved here in terms of this double the security provision amount, double the security deposit, is not a compensatory monetary amount, and therefore, because it's not covered. I did not understand the question you were asking, so I did not answer it correctly or as clearly as I should have. I I jumped to the exclusion point. I now understand what you were asking, and it is not covered because it is not a compensatory monetary award or amount. And that, I think, answered the question that you were asking earlier, and I'm sorry that I was not clear on my answer, but I was not clear on what you were asking. At the end, Judge Ripple, with respect to the question of waiver or estoppel, first of all, again, we're coming up on a record of cross motions for summary judgment. There was nothing in this case at all found by the court below, no factual determination at all about the subject of prejudice. As far as waiver goes, again, this court's decision, the 2004 decision that I alluded to earlier, that case specifically holds, although admittedly under Indiana law, that where you have a provision and a policy, and it is against public policy, as it is in this case, because it's a penalty, waiver does not come into play. You cannot waive a condition of that sort. Otherwise, you'd be having people being able to violate the public policy, and that would go against the Mortensen decision in this case. So waiver is out, and there's no showing of estoppel.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.